ACEC is excited to announce that registration is now open for its fall conference taking place in Marco Island, Florida, this October. That's right, after a year of Zoom and virtual meetings, we're excited to be bringing our fall conference back as an in-person event. And we can't tell you how excited we are to look forward to seeing you there in person for all of the content, networking, and education that the fall conference is known for. Log on to www.acec.org for more information. We can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to the Engineering Influence Podcast, presented by the American Council of Engineering Companies and sponsored by the ACEC Life Health Trust. Today, we're talking with Charles Marone, an engineer and founder and president of Strong Towns, a grassroots organization that supports a drastically different model of development for America's cities, towns, and neighborhoods than the one we currently follow. In September, Marone will publish his next book on this subject titled Confessions of a Recovering Engineer, Transportation for a Strong Town. The book looks at how transportation infrastructure and values and assumptions behind it drive development in this country and offers an alternative, one that clashes in a lot of places with current engineering and cultural thinking. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jerry. It's really nice to be here.
So first, to start off, we probably need to create a shared vocabulary for this discussion. Would you explain what, in your view, is the difference between a road and a street, and then talk to us about a strode?
Yeah, absolutely. I was having difficulty explaining or conversing to my colleagues about this. And so I simplified it down to this idea that a road is a high-speed connection between two places. If we think about a modern highway as being a replacement of the railroad. When you take a railroad, you get on in one spot, you get off in another spot. You don't have frontage railroads and drive-through railroads. It's a high-speed connection between two places. But when you get to that place, there's a network of streets within that place. And that network of streets is actually the platform for building wealth. And so a street is a platform for building wealth and value and creating a place within a community. Good roads connect places. Great places have great streets. A strode is this hybrid between the two. We call it the futon of transportation. You know, futon's an uncomfortable couch that makes into an uncomfortable bed. And a strode is something that tries to be both street and road and underperforms at both. It tries to both move vehicles very quickly from one place to another, but also be a platform for building wealth in the community. And strodes wind up being really, really expensive to build. And they wind up not producing a whole lot of tax base. And they also wind up being very dangerous places.
Yeah, I as you point out in your book, our suburbs are basically strodes.
We built, you know, I think 90 plus percent of what we built over the last, certainly my lifetime, you know, I'm 48 now. So my professional career has been all about building strodes. And I think originally post-World War II, we had a better split, but over time we've pretty much migrated exclusively to strode building.
So rather than ask questions, I thought I would just take some quotes from your book and ask you to expand upon them.
Yeah.
And so the first one is, and these are all quotes, designing a forgiving street is opposite from designing a forgiving road.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is a great insight. I have a whole chapter on forgiving design, and I think it's important to point out, and I think maybe for your audience in particular, that forgiving design is one of the greatest breakthroughs of the engineering profession. It saved millions and millions of lives. When we go back to the early days of highway building, or the early days of just roadway building, we took cart paths through the woods and put high performance surfaces on them, and people started to die. And they would die because, you know, when you were riding in a cart and buggy and you came to that big tree or that gully or that large rock, you just went around it because at a cart speed, that was easy to do. But as soon as you have a high performance road surface and a high performance vehicle, that tree, that rock, that gully is something that's going to kill you if you lose control. And engineers recognize this, and they recognize early on that we could design features in our roadways to forgive the common mistakes that drivers make. Drivers sometimes, you know, swerve within their lane for whatever reason. They look down at the radio, or they lose attention or lose focus. And so we made wider lanes. When you're going really fast, we have wide lanes because we don't want people to get in collisions when they do this common thing. We made shoulders because people sometimes go off the road, and we wanted them to be able to recover before they get sucked into the ditch or what have you. And we made clear zones on the side of roads. So if you do go off and have all this kinetic energy driving very fast, that kinetic energy can be dissipated before you hit a tree or some type of obstacle. And this idea of forgiving the mistakes that drivers make has made our roads some of the safest places from a transportation perspective in the world. Our approach to road design is copied worldwide, and it has improved safety immensely. The problem is when you take those insights and you bring them into a city, you bring them onto city streets, and you say, we're going to make the lanes wider, and we're going to make a shoulder, and we're going to have clear zones. What it does is it licenses the driver to have a certain level of comfort in that environment. And their natural reaction to having that comfort is to speed up. And this has the perverse reaction of actually not forgiving the mistakes of people outside of a vehicle. So people outside of a vehicle who, I'm working on a thing right now where a kid was biking across a street trying to cross and he was hit and killed. You know, people who are standing on the side of the street and wind up hit by a car, or people who cross, you know, in different locations. We don't take into account the common mistakes that people outside a vehicle make. And on our streets, within our cities and our urban areas, those are the deadly ones. Those are the ones that create the most kind of chaos and tragedy. And I think as engineers, we not only have a moral responsibility, but I think we underestimate or underappreciate our capacity to actually take into account these mistakes and engineer solutions to them. I think we're missing a great opportunity to do good for society, you know, kind of modeled on the way we did good in the past in those early highway days.
Yeah, one of the most striking passages in your book that I recall was on State Street in Springfield, which took a real beating
yeah.
in your book, talking about a traffic light post on a corner next to a bench, and it was secured with shear bolts. So if a car came careening across, the driver would be okay because the structure would give, but anyone standing or sitting around it would be obviously hurt.
It's a jarring thing to consider, because I don't think the people who placed the breakaway pole there are not compassionate people. And I also don't think the people who placed the bench there are not compassionate people. I think it's probably two different subsets of people looking at things in two different ways. But the contrast between having this breakaway pole, where as an engineer, you're acknowledging that vehicles leave the road with enough frequency and enough force to justify the extra expense of putting this breakaway pole in. But yet it's right next to a bench and right next to, you know, a button that you would press to cross the street. I mean, that's the whole thing, is that this breakaway pole that cars will hit with enough frequency where we're going to go through the time and the expense to put it that way, also has a button on it that people standing naked, I mean, not naked clothes-wise, but bare to the world, are going to be standing in this exact place where we know cars go crashing through. I think once you recognize that, and as designers, we tend to compartmentalize those things, right? Like the bench people are different than the pole people, are different than the person designing the curb radius and all that. But if you can combine those three into one kind of awareness, it is very jarring. The situations that we put normal humans in, where we know there's going to be these high-speed collisions, not necessarily frequently in any one spot, but the number of occurrence make it statistically a very frequent occurrence nationwide.
Another quote you did was from your book is, traffic congestion is too important to be left to traffic engineers and transportation planners. If we had one goal, to create maximum congestion, they would design the system we have now.
Right. It's funny because we, as a public policy measure, have identified congestion as like the primary transportation problem we're dealing with. And I was certainly educated in this way. My early parts of my career were certainly with this mindset. We need to battle congestion because congestion is what is killing the economy, creating extra carbon emissions, wrecking people's lives. We need to get people home and get people to work so that they can be productive and get them home so they can be with their families. Yet I took Hydrology 101. And in Hydrology 101, we looked at these hydrologic watersheds and how, you know, if you get a little bit of rain over a watershed, it will start to accumulate in ditches and they'll pour into little streams and brooks and they'll pour into rivers. And pretty soon you get this accumulated flood in the major tributaries. And those floods are really expensive to deal with and they're really damaging to people and to property. And so in Hydrology 101, what we do is we actually go out to all those little places in the watershed that contribute, and we try to withhold that water. We have a little stormwater pond here and a little drainage ditch here and a little berm here to try to keep that water and allow it to soak in locally so it doesn't contribute to this overall flooding situation. Somehow, when we leave Hydrology 101 and we walk up the hallway to Traffic 101, all of those lessons of watershed and hierarchical networks get inverted and they're forgotten from Hydrology 101. And we go about creating these hierarchical networks that take local streets and bring them the traffic there into collector streets and bring the collector streets into arterials and the arterials into major arterials. And then somehow we are shocked when this system creates on a routine regular basis a flood. I point out that, you know, my little city of 14,000, we have a rush hour here. It lasts about 5 minutes or 10 minutes every day. But if you went out and asked the people who are trying to get to work all at the same time from all over our commuter shed and wind up in the same place that they're funneled, they would say congestion here is unbearable. We need to do something, because for the brief period of time that they experience it, it is horrible. If we went to a major metropolitan area, those rush hour commutes, congestion periods can last hours. They can last all day sometimes in some places. But this is all a function of Hydrology 101. And as engineers, we know this and understand it. I'm not sure why we don't make these connections more readily. But the answer to traffic congestion is not to build a wider river. It's not to build a bigger tributary. I mean, we know that and recognize that in Hydrology 101. The way to address, particularly if we're trying to be cost effective, the way to address congestion is to keep those trips from happening, to actually absorb those trips locally. And that means things like corner stores and local shops and working from home and all these other things that are tools, not necessarily in the engineer's toolbox, but are tools in society's toolbox that we could exercise a little bit more prudently to address this issue.
And you make the point, and I've heard it made before by many times, which is that if you build a road, they will come, sort of thing.
Yeah. Well, traffic, I think this is one of the things that our models don't get at, right? Our models, even the ones that are the most complex, I think don't fully respect the dynamism of humans. I mean, the way that we act and respond dynamically to systems. So, you know, I know if we're going to go somewhere and we're anticipating a lot of traffic congestion and we have to be there at a certain time, we will do what? We will leave really early. We will give ourselves a lot of extra time. We will make different choices about things. We're dynamic humans. We respond that way. If we know that the road's going to be completely clear, well, then, you know, if I got to go get milk at 8 a.m., I won't wait till 10 o'clock. I'll just go at 8. You know, I there's no hindrance on me. I think as engineers, we kind of default to treating these systems as merely mechanical and overlook or deeply discount the dynamic nature that just human decision-making brings to these processes.
Yeah, you make the point. I'd hate to be a traffic forecaster. You make the point in it that you said traffic forecasting is a practice so lacking in rigor and substance that it should bring shame and embarrassment to anyone who considers themselves an engineer. The goal is to create a plausible narrative as to why more construction is both needed and helpful.
I think this particular quote combines two different thoughts.
Okay.
And let me try to make both of these thoughts concisely. The first one is the idea of traffic modeling and the idea that these systems are dynamic. Let me give you, I think, what is the most dramatic example, and that would be when the I-35W bridge collapsed here in Minnesota. I remember this distinctly. I'm from Minnesota. I had friends that were actually near the bridge when it came down. I'm an engineer, so this fascinated me in a number of ways. The projections then immediately from engineers, my colleagues here in Minnesota, was that traffic congestion was going to be horrible throughout the Twin Cities metropolitan area. There's something like 200,000 cars a day that go over the 35W bridge. It's a major corridor. Traffic congestion was going to be horrible. Expect terrible commutes, and this is going to persist for a long, for 2 years till we get this bridge rebuilt. The exact opposite happened. Commutes shortened. Things became easier. There was not this snarling of traffic that they projected, and the reason why is because people, in anticipation of it being bad, made other choices. They took the bus. They worked from home. They left at different times. They took different routes. They did different things. And as engineers, we had no, we were wrong in our predictions, but we also really had no basis to explain this in any of our models. Our models assume that, the vehicles would drive in a somewhat like linear fashion. I think the question then, and the second part of that quote, really gets to the idea of how we use traffic models. And this will upset a few people who are in the traffic modeling business, but I think step back and look at it and look at the way your work is used. It's not used to go back and check, were we right or wrong about what we projected 10 years ago or 20 years ago? Why were we wrong? Why didn't we get this right? There's no rigor of modeling the way you see in even like climate modeling, where the idea is to backtest things and figure out why. Certainly in economic modeling, it's everything is backtested and backtested and used to project out. And there's all this kind of rigor about why, things don't work out according to our models. In the engineering profession, we have none of that, we don't employ that. And so the question becomes why? In economic modeling, there's huge rigor in backtesting because there's a lot of money to be made if you can actually project things. In engineering, the money to be made is actually in projecting a lot of traffic. Because when you can project a positive outcome, we're gonna have all this traffic, and if we can do this project, it will alleviate that. We're gonna wanna build this transit system, and if we do that, there's gonna be all this traffic that happens or all this user demand. It drives more investment in engineering and more investment in projects. And so I think if modeling people want to be taken seriously, and if we as a profession want to use modeling, we have to actually devote way more rigor to backtesting, analyzing why things didn't work out, being very humble in our assumptions and humble in what we would know. And very hard on ourselves when we, in a sense, can project the outcome we want. When we get the answer we want, we should question that more than when we get the answer we don't want. And that's not an internal part of our dialogue at all.
Kind of jumping around here, but...
By the way, Gary, could I... Mm-hmm. I left that way. Let me say this. I don't think that makes engineers bad. I think it makes us human. Right. And I think we have to be aware that we are human like everybody else.
I think that's fair. Yes. Another quote here is, if I could, I would eliminate every traffic signal in every city in North America.
I would tomorrow.
And why is that?
Traffic signals are the most maddening thing that we have done as a profession. We place them mindlessly in places and create all kinds of not only delay for people that's unnecessary, but all kinds of congestion and really dangerous traffic situations. When you dig into the rationale for traffic signals, it's tied very, very closely to the speed at which traffic travels. We have decided that in our streets, 30 miles an hour is a safe speed. Sometimes cities will sign, you know, put enforcement up where they'll put a maximum speed limit at 25. I've seen a few places where they do 20, but these are rare exceptions. But from a design standpoint, we will design these 30 mile an hour environments almost indistinguishable from environments that are marked at 40, 45, even 50 miles per hour or greater. Our design speed is much higher than what the enforced speed actually is. Because of this high speed, and by high speed, I'm talking about, this is a strode environment again. These are speeds that exceed what you would want on a street where you're trying to create wealth and build a place. You really want speeds that are 10 miles an hour, 15 miles an hour, somewhere in that range. When we have these high speeds for a street, what we are forced to do then is to create signalized intersections so that we can create gaps in the traffic flow to allow people to make left turn movements and turn in and out of traffic. We're required to stop traffic so people can cross on foot. We're required to stop traffic so that people can cross in their vehicles and be cross traffic. All of these things create massive inefficiencies in the system and massive increases in travel time. A traffic signal allows you the right to drive 30 miles an hour when the signal is green. But when the signal is red, you go zero. And there have been some really good analyses. I've done my own here, but in other places too. And then there's some theoretical modeling that has looked at this, that has said, you know, the average travel speed in an urban environment is 9, 10, 11 miles an hour. You know, you're going 30 when you're traveling and you're going zero when you're sitting there. And when you average out the travel time, you actually don't get to where you're going very quickly. If we reduce speeds, if we took speeds down to what would be an apocryphal level for the modern engineering profession, a 10 mile an hour or a 15 mile an hour speed, and got rid of the signalized intersections and made them either traffic circles, kind of continuous flow intersections, or some type of shared space environment where you would literally, like driving through a parking lot, just kind of navigate through at very low speeds, what we would find is that not only would we be building environments that are safer, and that produced more wealth, had greater wealth creation capacity, but you'd actually get to where you're going more quickly. You'd actually get to your destination faster, traveling slower than, you know, you're more quickly traveling slower. And then you get there longer with a greater time interval traveling faster. And I think that recognition or that realization it should be an embarrassment to, you know, the engineering profession, which I think started from a place where we have, you know, this intersection problem and we're going to deal with it with signals. And then signals started to migrate to places that really didn't need them or shouldn't have them. If you go back to old street design, street design in the past was you would just place like a post in the middle of the street. And the idea was, is you had to just drive around this post. And what it forced is kind of like a, you know, a counterclockwise motion of travel, very tight turning radiuses. So you couldn't go through fast. You had to go through slow because if you're going to, you know, go around a post in the middle, you're taking a 90 degree corner. And it enforced a certain kind of socialness to the space that both took care of traffic and allowed people to get to where they needed to go. I would bring that back in a heartbeat. I'd bring back the cop standing in the middle of the intersection, waving people through as a beautiful way for people to get around.
It would be calmer, definitely.
It would be calmer. And I think the insight here is that you would get to where you're going more quickly in most instances at most points of the day.
This is a quote. Federal government should fund roads only. There should not be federal spending, building, expanding, or maintaining streets. Why do you believe that?
You mentioned State Street earlier, and you did it in passing. I think it's important because State Street in Springfield, Massachusetts is the literary device I've used to write this book around. There was a tragic crash that occurred there that a young girl was killed. And I tried to explain why it wasn't the mom's fault and why the choices that she made were not the primary thing that influenced the outcome of that event. Part of that is a recognition that State Street is what in Massachusetts is a state aid street. Here in my hometown of Brainerd, the street in front of my house is a state aid street. That means it gets federal funding filtered through the state to basically fund the local street in front of my house. The local street in the core of downtown Springfield, Massachusetts is funded by the federal government through this program. And if you look at the basis of the program and the idea of it, it is to create this regional network of transportation under the guise of really what is a road mentality. It is good for the economy if people can start in Minneapolis and get to Chicago very quickly. It's good for the economy if farmers in North Dakota can quickly get to Duluth and bring their goods to the port there and ship them out around the world. It's great for the economy. We took that insight and we said, it's great for the economy if people can get from North Brainerd to South Brainerd very quickly, going through what is a residential neighborhood. It's great for the economy if people can get from West Springfield to East Springfield, driving at high, not neighborhood speeds through the core of Springfield, Massachusetts. That latter assumption is wrong. It's just incorrect. And I understand why people made that assumption, but it's incorrect. And I think we've known for a long time that it's incorrect. The problem is the money stream. It is really hard for cities to give up on this money stream. My city council would love for 4th Street, the street in front of my house, to no longer be a state aid street. They do not want it to be excessively wide. They do not want the traffic to go through there very quickly. They have to do those things because they have to meet the state aid standards, the federal standards that our state has adopted in order to have this state aid program. They would like it to be a local street with slow speeds, with parking on both sides, with street trees, with sidewalks, because these are the things that build wealth. These are the things that build a great neighborhood, make a great community. They're not able to put those things in because the federal, the state aid standards that were required to get the federal money. I would like to see the federal government become really competent, really, really competent at maintaining interstate infrastructure, the infrastructure of the nation, our ports, our canals, our airports, our interstate system. I would like to see them get out of the business of trying to build local streets, local trails, local sidewalks, safe routes to school. I think these are all important things and I really believe in them. And if you read my book, you're not gonna come away thinking that I'm discounting the investments in sidewalks and place. I think they're critical, but I think that the driver of them needs to be local government. I think local government has a real vested interest financially and human-wise in making great places. And I think that the federal funding actually gets in the way and distorts us from doing things that are very logical for us to do because we're getting this money. I don't have a problem with the federal government giving the cities money for transportation, but I would like it funneled not through these regional transportation programs that require us to build roads through neighborhoods. I would like to see it just given directly to cities with as few strings as possible.
Related to that, another quote being, the only viable alternative to a despotic system of ubiquitous congestion, faulty modeling, and overengineering is to strengthen neighborhoods. How does your concept strengthen neighborhoods?
When we focus on roads and streets, so when we have roads that connect places, and when we have streets that build wealth within a place, what we're ultimately doing is investing in great human habitat, great places for people to live. I can while simultaneously, you know, connecting us to the outside world. In that scenario, I have the option within my neighborhood of getting my groceries locally, of walking to a restaurant, of having essentially a complete functioning traditional neighborhood, the kind of neighborhoods that humans have lived in really for all of human history, minus the last 75 years. I have the option to do all of that within my place. I also have the option, because we've invested in roads to connect me to other places, I also have the option of getting in my car and going to a neighboring place, going, you know, getting somewhere else quickly. The trade-off, and I think the dynamism here of building human habitats, is that if the burden of getting to that next place becomes high, it actually creates a market for doing things locally. If I have to get in my car and drive 20 miles to get a quart of milk and a loaf of bread, well, someone putting in a corner store in my neighborhood is going to have me as a potential market person. And I may even pay a little bit of a premium there so I can save myself the 40 minutes round trip of driving to this other destination. You start to build enough of those things in, and what you create is the financial incentive to improve places and make them more livable, more enjoyable, places that really people want to live in. I think what we've done today, well, let me say this a little bit differently. What we have done today financially is create a lot of places that lack the tax base to actually sustain themselves long term. And so in order to resolve that problem, we need our cities, our neighborhoods, to actually thicken up. The problem is that because of the way we invest in transportation, we try to solve all of these problems by building more transportation. How do we get the next interchange? How do we get the next frontage road? How do we get the next set of big box stores and franchise restaurants? Those are the things that are actually putting our local governments into insolvency. And so if we want to reverse that while simultaneously getting people on board with the program, we have to make it so that people enjoy a higher quality of life at the end of a thickening up of the neighborhood. It can't be what planners do, which is often go in and like force density on a place. It can't be what engineers do, which is go in and say, we're gonna take out this row of businesses so we can put in two more lanes. The dynamic has to be an incremental one where people are able to respond to the stress of congestion by actually welcoming and accepting and building stuff within their neighborhood that benefits them and has value for them.
Finally, I'm just sort of getting to the end here. What in your book, you recall that back in the 1990s, you were at a conference where they were discussing the complete streets concept. And you and your colleagues sort of laughed about the idea, thinking it was a joke.
Yeah.
But then you make the point that today it's a accepted design practice. Do you see that happening with the strong towns concept?
That's a really good question. Let me back up and walk through the complete streets thing a little bit, because I feel like I've learned a lot from complete streets, both good and bad. So complete streets is this idea that a street should accommodate everyone. It should accommodate people in cars. It should accommodate people walking, people biking. It should accommodate transit. I've referred to it a little bit as like the Oprah approach to engineering, which is, you know, Oprah, you go to her show and like, you know, hey, look under your chair, like you get a car and you get a car and you get a car, like everybody gets something. And Complete Streets is like, you get a lane, you get a lane, you get a lane, like everybody gets a lane. And at the end of the day, like everybody can be happy because you all get your own stuff in this space. There's something very American about that. And I think there's also something very engineering in the worst sense, like mechanical about that. Because what it does is it says that instead of actually having nuance and complication and working out things where there's diverging interests and tension, we'll just solve this by throwing a ridiculous sum of money at it and giving everybody what they want, exclusive of everybody else. That works in an environment where you have unlimited resources. And that works in an environment where you basically have the capacity to fix and provide a high level of stuff for everybody who steps up to the table. We do not live in that environment, and we never will, and we never can. I think that the great part of Complete Streets is that they identified a problem. The bad part of Complete Streets is that the solution was easily co-opted by a system that is ravenous to build more and spend more and have more resources flowing through it. Will strong towns become that? I actually fear that. And I think as an organization, we could grow our movement and grow our conversation a lot more quickly if we gave ourselves over to kind of rote approaches. I think our hyper insistence on local nuance, on what we call messiness, on complexity, makes it so that the idea of a strong towns can scale greatly, but the implementation of it really can't. It's not something that can be standardized and come out the other end well. And I've always kind of resisted notions that we could do that. You know, give us the zoning code that produces a strong town. Well, there isn't one, because your city is different than mine. It's different than the one up the street. We're all in different places and different phases of development. Give us the street standard that produces a strong town. Well, streets are, as I say in the book, more of an art than a science. You actually have to get to know the place and build the nuance of that place. And so I think if strong towns is done well, the idea of it, the goals and the perspectives and maybe the questions that you ask would become like Complete Streets, more standardized and more broadly adopted. The idea of a street design team being the way you would approach street design, as opposed to giving it to the public works director or the engineer to just do and let everyone else comment. That's something we can standardize and come up with an approach. But the idea that a strong town approach in your city would look like one in mine, I think if we get to that, we failed as a movement. I don't see us going that way.
Well, great. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Hey, thank you. This has been a lot of fun. I hope people get a lot out of the conversation and the book too. It's an important one for our colleagues to delve into, and I look forward to their feedback too. I know it won't all be positive, and I think that's going to be a healthy part of the discussion too.
Okay. Well, thanks for listening to the Engineering Influence Podcast.